Chapter 7, Attempt, Conspiracy, and Solicitation. We're now going to look at inchoate, I-N-C-H-O-A-T-E, or beginning crimes. Inchoate crimes provide that individuals can be convicted and punished for an intent to commit a crime when accompanied by a significant step towards the commission of the offense. At this point, society is confident that the individual presents a threat and is society feels justified in acting to protect itself. There are three inchoate crimes. Attempt, an unsuccessful effort to commit a crime. A conspiracy, an agreement to commit a crime and an overt act in furtherance of this agreement. And thirdly, solicitation, an effort to persuade another to commit a crime. The conviction for an individual for an inchoate crime requires a specific intent or purpose to accomplish the criminal offense, an act to carry out this purpose. Inchoate offenses generally are punished less severely or by the same sentence as the criminal object of the attempt, conspiracy, or solicitation. An attempt is actually punishing a failure to succeed. There are two types of attempts, complete attempt and incomplete attempt. A complete but imperfect attempt occurs when an individual takes every step required to commit a crime and yet fails to succeed. An example is an individual who fires a weapon and misses the intended victim. In the case of an incomplete attempt, an individual abandons or is prevented from completing a shooting due to the arrival of the police or as a result of some other event outside his or her control. A third category that we might mention are impossible attempts. This arises where the perpetrator makes a mistake, such as aiming and firing a gun only to realize that it is not loaded. Keep these categories in mind as you read the cases on attempt. Well, the major debate in the law of attempt is how far an individual must progress towards the completion of the crime to be held legally liable for an attempt. Is it only when you pull the trigger and miss? What if you aim the gun with an intent to shoot it? The conflict here is that should society intervene as soon as we're confident that a person has a criminal intent, or should we wait until the individual pulls the trigger to give them every opportunity to avoid committing the crime? Or if we wait that long, do we place society in danger? Nice little hypothetical, well not hypothetical, nice actual case from California here, discussed on 190 is People v. Miller. Miller is angry at Jeans, goes to where Jeans works with his .22 caliber rifle. Jeans sees Miller get out of his car and starts running away. Miller keeps walking towards Jeans, at one point even stops and appears to load the rifle. But it just so happens that Ginocchio, the sheriff, owns the farm where Jeans works and is in the field at the moment. And Miller continues walking towards Jeans, who is now running, and eventually hands the rifle to Ginocchio. Has Miller gone far enough for there to be an attempt? Clearly Jeans, as soon as he saw Miller, fled on a right angle to Miller's line of approach. But it's not clear whether this occurred before or after Miller apparently placed a bullet in the rifle. The firearm was loaded with a high-speed cartridge. Yet at no time did Miller raise and aim the rifle. Was Miller's mere appearance at the farm with the earlier stated attempt to get even with Jeans sufficient for an attempt? On the other hand, did Miller merely want to frighten Jeans, or was Miller intent on killing him? Was Miller intent on wounding him? Was it an attempted assault or an attempted intent to kill? Should we consider Jeans' reaction in trying to evaluate Miller's guilt? Why would Miller show up at a farm owned by the sheriff if his intent was to kill Jeans? So based on these facts, would you hold Miller liable for an attempt? The early common law did not punish attempt. The crime of attempt was really not recognized until the beginning of the 19th century, where it was fully accepted. The theory is that if anybody who has the intent to commit a crime really is as morally blameworthy as somebody who carries the crime out. For success or failure may depend on an unpredictable factor, such as whether the victim moved to the left or right, or whether the assailant was distracted when he or she fired and missed. The lesser punishment for an attempt also may give people a incentive to abandon their criminal design. If we punish attempt equally with the completion of the act, then an individual who was engaged in attempt would have no incentive to withdraw from the criminal activity. So the law wants to have this intermediate offense. The person is morally blameworthy, but we want to give them the opportunity to withdraw from their criminal activity. And when we talk about abandonment, we'll see that you actually can commit an attempt, abandon your purpose, and not be held liable. Because the law wants to encourage you not to go through with the crime. So by having this intermediate punishment, the law is in a sense giving you a safe haven or an opportunity to withdraw from your criminal activity. And thirdly, if you've committed an attempt, as we've indicated, you've demonstrated that you pose a threat to society. So we can summarize this as saying, well, the law wants retribution because you had a criminal intent. You took an act towards realizing that intent. You're morally blameworthy. And the fact whether you succeeded or not really is often unpredictable and due to unforeseen circumstances. So there is this element of retribution for what you've done. Second, utilitarian. The lesser punishment for attempt provides an incentive for individuals to halt before completing a criminal act in order to avoid being subjected to a harsher punishment. And incapacitation, the individual has demonstrated that he or she poses a threat to society. A criminal intent has three elements: an intent or purpose to commit a crime, an act or act towards the commission of the crime, and thirdly, a failure to complete the crime. A general attempt statute punishes an attempt to commit any criminal offense. Other statutes may be directed at specific offenses, such as an attempt to commit murder, robbery, or rape. Then there's a third group of statutes that punish things such as possession of burglar tools. Really, we consider that to be preparation for an attempt, but the law is intervening in a very early stage at that point. So the Wyoming statute on attempt reads, with an intent, a person is guilty of attempt to commit a crime if with the intent to commit a crime, he does any act which is a substantial step towards the commission of the crime. A substantial step is conduct which is strongly corroborative of the firmness of the person's intention to complete the commission of the crime. So an attempt, in other words, is a step towards the completion of the crime, specific intent or purpose to commit the crime. Thirdly, a failure to complete the crime. What is the mens rea of attempt? An individual must intentionally perform acts that are proximate to the completion of a crime. Secondly, an individual must possess a specific intent or purpose to achieve a criminal objective. In the case of an individual accused of attempted murder, the prosecution must demonstrate, one, the defendant intentionally aimed and engaged in an act towards the shooting of the bow and arrow, two, undertaken with the intent to kill a hunter walking on the trail, and a defendant who did not notice the hunter and lacked the intent to kill would not be liable for attempted premeditated murder. So, we have an act that are proximate to the completion of the crime and a specific intent. So the commentary of the Model Penal Code offers the example of an individual who detonates a bomb with the purpose of demolishing a building, knowing that people are inside. In the event the bomb proves defective, the commentary notes that the defendant likely would not be held responsible for attempted murder because his or her purpose was to destroy the building rather than to kill the individuals inside. I think you'll find an interesting case on 192 Smallwood v. State. Smallwood knows that he has HIV. He's informed as such, told not to engage in unprotected sexual activity. Yet, Smallwood and an accomplice are involved in 3 rapes. And during these episodes, Smallwood threatens to kill his victims if they don't cooperate. Well, he's charged with attempted intentional murder. So the issue is, was there sufficient evidence that Smallwood intended to kill his 3 victims? Smallwood argues that the fact that he had HIV is insufficient to infer an intent to kill. The most that can be reasonably inferred is that he is guilty of recklessly endangering his victims by exposing them to the risk that they may become infected themselves. The state disagreed, arguing that the facts of this case are sufficient to infer an intent to kill. The state analogizes Smallwood's HIV to a dangerous weapon. Well, we have to consider whether there is sufficient evidence to infer an intent to kill, and precisely what is the relationship between HIV and autoimmune deficiency syndrome or AIDS. So that's a case interesting to think about. And a nice example of what we can infer from the facts is in the You Decide on 7.1, which you might find interesting in looking at. Actus rei of an attempt. Actus rei of an attempt. This is probably one of the most confusing areas. A good way to think about this is 2 different approaches. The objective approach to criminal attempt requires an act that comes extremely close to the commission of the crime. An arsonist, for instance, must spread the kerosene on the ground surrounding a house and then strike a match. At this point, although the match may be blown out, we can be confident the arsonist possesses the intent to commit the crime and is far enough along that he or she likely would not back out but for the wind blowing out the match. And we can be fairly confident then that given every opportunity to back out of this plot, the individual failed to do so. Now, the objective approach distinguishes between preparation, which is buying the material to burn the house, and an attempt. The subjective approach is just really an opposite tact. That says, as soon as you've committed, your acts are such that we can confidently infer an intent to burn the house down, we should hold you liable because at this point you possess a threat to society and you shouldn't be free of criminal liability. It's early intervention. We're not going to give you, of course, this opportunity to change your mind because you probably won't. So the objective approach stresses the danger posed by the defendant's acts. Subjective approach focuses on the danger to society presented by the defendant's criminal intent. So there are a number of very kind of confusing and often indistinguishable tests for attempt to discuss on 196. The last step approach was used at common law, which basically said you have to do everything but the final act. It says that following the completion of the final step required for the commission of the crime, only then do we have an attempt. In other words, an attempted arson requires that an individual actually ignite a fire before he or she could be arrested or for an attempt. In attempted murder, the assailant must pull the trigger only to miss the target. So, essentially, it's an unsuccessful effort to complete the crime. The physical proximity test is the same, just short of that. Follows the objective approach, provides an attempt occurs when an act is very near or dangerously close to the completion of the crime. And an individual must possess the immediate ability to complete the crime, or in the words of the court, the act must amount to the commencement of the consummation. Under this test, the arsonist would be required to spread the kerosene and the on the building and to strike a match. The killer must aim a rifle at the victim and have the victim within sight of the rifle. At this point, the individual has not taken the opportunity to back out and clearly has the intent to carry out their offense. The unequivocality test, or res ipsa loquitur, e.g. the thing speaks for itself in Latin translation, asks whether an ordinary individual observing the defendant's act would conclude that the defendant clearly and undisputably intends to commit a crime. The focus is on what an individual has already done. Defendant's statements to the police or to other persons are not considered in the analysis. Perhaps the moment the arsonist arrives at the scene with the necessary materials, most people would conclude that the defendant possesses a clear intent and is guilty of attempted arson. Now, this test obviously doesn't have clear guidelines. So you look at what's going on, you say, is it just very clear, looking at this objectively, not looking at any statements or rhetoric or background, that this person has the intent to carry out this crime? And under this unequivocality test, we can be very further removed from the completion of the crime than under the last step or physical proximity test. But probably the physical proximity test is a popular test and fairly easy to understand. That is, everything but the last act to complete the crime, pretty much. And then the other main test is from the Model Penal Code, the substantial step test. Now, this is on the other end of the spectrum. The substantial step test simplifies matters by providing an understandable and easily applied test for attempt. It states that to constitute an attempt, an act must be a clear step towards the commission of the crime. This step is not required to be close to the completion of the crime itself. The Model Penal Code does state the act must be strongly corroborative of the actor's criminal purpose. So if the physical proximity test says you've got to come very close to undertaking this crime, this test says you've got to take a clear step towards the crime such that we can infer a criminal purpose. So this test is really maximizing the intervention of the law. The focus is on what you've done, and does that indicate, is that a substantial test towards the completion of the crime such that we can infer an intent? Now, the Model Penal Code lists a number of examples of what it means by a substantial test. Step, lying in wait, searching for or following the contemplated victim, enticing the victim to go to the place contemplated for its commission, surveillance of the site of the contemplated crime, unlawful entry of a building or vehicle that is the site of a contemplated crime, possession of material specifically designed for the commission of the offense, and soliciting an individual to engage in conduct constituting a crime. Again, the physical proximity test says come very close to committing the crime. The Model Penal Code substantial test analysis concentrates on asking whether an individual has taken affirmative steps towards the completion of a crime that, in combination with other evidence, indicates the defendant possesses a criminal intent. These steps are not required to be physically proximate or close to the offense, and there's no firm distinction between preparation and perpetration of a crime. In fact, you might even consider something like lying in wait, following the contemplated victim, as preparation. Under the Model Penal Code, concerns with detaining dangerous persons rather than with delaying an arrest until an individual comes close to committing a dangerous act. Well, what's an example of the difference between physical proximity and substantial test? On 197, you'll see Commonwealth v. Gilliam, where Pennsylvania Superior Court actually compares the tests and says that the holding this individual liable for taking a substantial step towards escape from prison. That same evidence under the physical proximity test may not be sufficient. So Gilliam was a prisoner at the Dallas State Correctional Institution, and correctional officers discovered the bars on the window in his cell had been cut and were being held in place by sticks and paper. Search the cell revealed vice grips concealed inside Gilliam's mattress, and two knotted extension cords attached to a hook were found in a box of clothing. The vice grips were sufficiently strong to cut through the barbed wire along the top of the fence surrounding the institution, and the extension cords presumably were to be used to scale the surrounding penitentiary wall. A Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that Gilliam's sawing through the bars and gathering of tools indicated a clear intent to escape, and noted that these same acts would not constitute an attempt under a physical proximity test because a number of additional steps were required to escape from the prison, but they would be sufficient to, under the substantial step test, because it's a clear step towards the commission of the crime, and that step allows us to infer a criminal intent. So, but under substantial, under the physical proximity test, he's only cut through the bars. He hasn't even tried to exit the cell. He hasn't really started to go out the window. He hasn't tried to climb over the fence. In other words, we want to come very close to the completion of the crime. We just don't want to base it on intent because he may never act on that intent. We never know people's intent in general. We have to speculate. Well, the next case in the book, Bolton on 197, interesting case. Our defendant, Bolton, is standing outside the window, presumably watching a young woman take a bath. It's at night. He's got army fatigues. Very important. When arrested, he also has in his possession, in addition to the camouflage pants, his zipper is open and he has a open jar of petroleum jelly found in his pocket. And based on his standing outside her window, the petroleum jelly, the camouflage pants, and evidence that basically the court did not find to be... There also was evidence that our defendant, Bolton, had followed this young girl at one point, but the court seemed to minimize that evidence because the state failed to prove that that had preceded his appearance at the window in the immediate, that it was proximate to the to his appearing in her window. There was no indication when that had occurred. Also, there was no evidence that the window had been, there had been an attempt on his part to go through the window and actually engage in a physical assault or threaten her. The most that appeared to be able to be established was that he appeared in the window. So in this case, it was ruled that he really had not gone beyond mere preparation, that the evidence could not sustain a conviction for attempt, even though the jury had, in fact, committed him of attempted sexual assault, which is fairly amazing on this evidence, but perhaps indicates the degree to which society wants to intervene as early as possible to prevent sexual assaults and whether the law is getting in the way of the enforcement of that particular law. Now, two more interesting aspects to attempt. Number one, impossibility. Well, we know from our discussion of mistakes that legal impossibility is a defense. A group of 18-year-old college freshmen who go into a bar with the intent to drink and with money in their pocket, at that point have the requisite intent to engage in underage drinking, but and they've committed an act in furtherance of that intent, but it very well could be that the age of consent is 18, not 21, and therefore it's legally impossible for them to commit a crime. Professor Jerome Hall notes somewhat humorously, it's not a crime to throw cans of steak in the garbage. An individual who makes an effort to toss the steak in the garbage is not guilty of an attempted offense. Now, legal factual impossibility is another matter. It's not a defense to attempt to an attempt to commit a crime. This is based on the fact that an offender who possesses a criminal intent and who takes steps to commit an offense should not be free from legal guilt. The factual circumstance that prevents an individual from actually completing the offense is referred to in some state statutes as an extraneous factor or an event outside of the individual's control. Again, the rule is that a mistake concerning the facts is not a defense. A mistake concerning the law is a defense. We should also mention inherent possibility. There's an English case in which an individual who stuck pins in a voodoo doll was acquitted of attempted murder. Clearly, it was we call that inherent impossibility. That you committed an act, you had the intent, but as far as modern society is concerned, it's not sufficient to prove an attempted homicide. So State v. Glass has to do with an individual charged with attempted lewd conduct with a minor under 16. He goes on to a chat room. He contacts a young woman who he believes is an underage juvenile. They arrange for a meeting. First, he drives over and picks up a picture that she leaves for him, and she's to meet with him the next morning. He drives over to meet her. She's not there. He turns around, starts to speed away. He's pulled over by the police. They charge him with attempted lewd conduct with a minor under 16. Now, what's interesting about this case is there is no minor. The other person on the other end were the police officers. They made up this identity. So we know that it was factually impossible for him to attempt lewd conduct, but if factual impossibility is not a defense. And his driving over there to, then he argues, well, I haven't gone far enough for attempted lewd conduct. Now, here you might be somewhat sympathetic to his argument, not to him. After all, they exchanged interaction on the internet. He drove over, picked up her picture, drove over to meet her, but she was never actually in the car. Under a test that emphasizes the objective nature of the attempt, it could really be argued he hasn't gone far enough. But if we're only focusing on intent, I don't think there's any question that he's guilty. So you'd have a conflict again between the physical proximity test and the Model Penal Code substantial step test here, I think, in terms of whether to hold him guilty. We have to also examine what he said on the internet. He asked her about her past sexual experiences and offered to go to her house that day and to be her sex slave. He very well knew she was 14. And he had pushed her he wanted to come over, and she said that she couldn't come over because her mom was there. And she then later contacts him. He contacts her again a week later and asks whether she had found a house that the two could use. And she said, yeah, I have a friend's house. So he definitely had the intent, based on his statements, knowing he was 14, he definitely took the initiative in contacting her. He definitely drove over, picked up a picture, definitely was going over to meet her, definitely had the intent, but did this go far enough in terms of the act itself? And I think there's a really interesting you decide on 7.3 about an attempted assassination of President Clinton talking about impossibility. Now, a second really interesting aspect of the law of attempt is abandonment. An individual who abandons an attempt to commit a crime based on the intervention of outside or extraneous or an extraneous factor remains criminally liable. On the other hand, what about an individual who voluntarily abandons his or her criminal scheme after completing an attempt? Well, the rule is if you voluntarily abandon the criminal offense, and it's not the product of an extraneous factor, meaning the imminent arrival of the police, that it's not the fact that the emergency alarm rang in the hospital when you were attempting to engage in some illegal activity and therefore abandon that because you were afraid of being caught. It's not that you go into a store to rob it and you have trouble opening the cash machine. There, you abandon your criminal intent in reaction to an extraneous or outside factor. So what the law is saying is, we're going to allow you to commit an attempt. You've technically violated the law, but you can renounce your criminal purpose, abandon your criminal activity, and there'll be no criminal liability attached to your action. So 205 Ross v. State, this guy's attempted, take on face value the court's conclusion that it was an attempted rape. She says, you know, you can't do this to me. My daughter's going to be coming home from school soon. She's all that she has in the world. Her father's dead. And he said, well, okay, under the circumstances, let's go outside, turn your back, I'm going to drive away. I'm going to walk away from this situation. He had pointed a handgun at her, ordered her into the house, told her to undress, and shoved her on the couch. 3 or 4 times he ordered her to undress, and once threatened to kill her. Well, you might ask, should we allow people to abandon their intent under attempted rape under those conditions? And did he do it voluntarily or in reaction to what she said? And there's an interesting you decide on 206 as well. Now, I think one of the most, so that covers attempt. I think one of the most confusing areas of the law really is the law of conspiracy, because it is very vague. Why do we punish? So again, conspiracy and agreement, two or more persons. Some jurisdictions require an act in furtherance of that attempt. Conspiracy, I'm sorry. Now, why do we punish conspiracy? Well, group activity poses more of a danger, so we're going to protect society by arresting individuals before they commit a dangerous crime. Secondly, as I noticed, group activities are generally more dangerous, more likely to be carried out. And because of group pressure, we need to deter individuals from engaging in criminal activity as a group. So the common law crime of conspiracy was complete with the agreement to commit a crime. Most modern statutes require an affirmative act, however slight, towards carrying out the conspiracy. Bear in mind that the common law conspiracy merged into a criminal act today, you can be held liable, and you usually are, for both the substantive act and a conspiracy to commit the bank robbery. So the conspiracy doesn't merge into the completed offense. And remember, you can be held liable for all acts undertaken in furtherance of the conspiracy, whether you commit them or another individual. You have a conspiracy to rob a bank, someone kills a guard, everyone in the conspiracy will be held liable. So it's really an agreement and some minor act in furtherance of that agreement. And again, under the so-called Pinkerton rule, if I'm in a conspiracy, I'm guilty of criminal acts committed by every other individual in that conspiracy, undertaken in furtherance of that conspiracy. I can be held liable both for the substantive crime itself and for a conspiracy to engage in that criminal activity. Its application is inherently vague. Actus rea, I enter into agreement. Secondly, an overt act in furtherance of the agreement is required under some modern statutes. Now, problem is, people who commit crimes don't usually sign contracts indicating that they agree to a criminal activity. So in Commonwealth versus Asim, Asim pulled his auto over to the curb on the Temple University campus. He had two individuals in his car, Robinson and Malise James. Robinson called to a nearby student. The student refused to respond, and Robinson and Malise James exited the auto, beat and choked the student, and took his wallet. Three then drove away from the area. The Pennsylvania Superior Court, in affirming Azam's conviction for conspiracy, pointed to Azam's association with the two assailants and the fact that Azim waited in the automobile with the engine running and lights on as the student was beaten. Clearly, if this had been part of an ongoing set of robberies, the court would have been more confident in inferring that Azim had entered into an agreement, but the fact that he waited there, watched what happened, could clearly know what happened, the court used those facts to infer that he entered into an agreement with them with the intent to rob somebody. And so, even though Asim was driving the car, as a conspirator, he's held liable for all acts undertaken by Robinson and Azim as his co-conspirators. And if it was only agreed that they would have, let's say, beaten the student, and instead they assaulted and killed him, Azim would be guilty as the murderer's foreseeability. So conspiracy can be quite draconian because everyone involved in that conspiracy, if someone, let's say, if they used a gun and someone had entered in the conspiracy or helped plan it, gotten them a gun with the intent of carrying out this plan, that individual would be guilty of all acts undertaken pursuant to the conspiracy. So it's quite oppressive on defendants, because even though I enter into an agreement, I'm going to be held liable for the substantive crime. So an overt act by any party to a conspiracy is attributed to every member and provides a sufficient basis for prosecuting all the participants. The requirement of an overt act is intended to limit conspiracy prosecutions to agreements that have progressed beyond the stage of discussion and therefore present a social danger. So, overt act. You need an agreement, and in many jurisdictions, or an overt act in furtherance of that agreement. An overt act is satisfied by even an insignificant act that's far removed from the commission of the crime. As observed by Judge Oliver Wendell Holmes, the essence of the conspiracy is being combined for an unlawful purpose, and if an overt act is required, it does not matter how remote the act may be from accomplishing the purpose if done to effect it. Attending a meeting of the Communist Party was considered to constitute an overt act in furtherance of the Communist conspiracy to overthrow the United States government, and purchasing large quantities of dynamite satisfied the overt act requirement for conspiracy to blow up a school building. In other cases, the overt act has been satisfied by observing the movements of an intended victim, kidnapping victim by putting them under surveillance, or by purchasing stamps to send poison through the mail. In other words, you need an agreement and an overt act by one party to fulfill the requirements for a conspiracy. Not everyone needs to undertake an overt act. One person is sufficient. Again, statements made by anyone in the conspiracy can be introduced against all conspirators as well. There are many rules that make this what's called prosecutor's little darling. Now, the mens rea of conspiracy is the intent to achieve the object of the agreement. Some judges continue to express uncertainty whether this requires a purpose to cause a result or whether it's sufficient that an individual knows that a result will occur. The best rule is that an intent is required. That seems to be the majority rule. However, a knowledge standard may deter individuals from providing assistance to individuals whom they are aware or suspect are engaged in criminal activity. On the other hand, limiting liability to individuals with a criminal purpose targets individuals who intend to further criminal conduct. Well, this may seem harsh to you. This may seem somewhat harsh to you, but it really is a matter of social policy. The general rule is you must have a specific intent to further the purpose of the conspiracy, that you must want to see the conspiracy achieved, and knowledge standard is not sufficient. Some courts impose a knowledge standard because they feel that deters individuals from assisting people who are engaged in illegal activity. So, for instance, the United States versus Falcone, United States Supreme Court decision, the United States Supreme Court ruled that individuals who provided large quantities of sugar, yeast, and cans to individuals whom they knew were engaged in illegally manufacturing alcohol were not liable for conspiracy. The court held the government was required to demonstrate the suppliers intended to promote the illegal activity. People v. Loria, a famous California appellate case, an individual operated a telephone message service and provided this service to clients, some of whom he knew were prostitutes. Now, the question was he merely knowingly providing this service to prostitutes, or whether he was trying to had the intent to further acts of prostitution? Well, the court rejected the prosecution's claim that Loria's knowledge that three of the customers were prostitutes satisfied the mental element required to hold Loria liable for conspiracy to commit prostitution. Court ruled that prosecution must demonstrate that Loria possessed an intent to further a criminal enterprise, and that there was insufficient evidence that Loria took any direct action to further encourage or direct the activities of these individuals engaged in prostitution. It was probably significant that only a small portion of Loria's business was derived from is a business associated with prostitutes, and that there was no evidence that he promoted or encouraged their activity or received substantial financial benefits. In other words, you can sell somebody a gun knowing they may engage in a bank robbery. That doesn't make you a conspirator. You must enter into agreement with them with the specific intent that they engage in the bank robbery. And again, remember, we must have an agreement undertaken with the specific intent to achieve this activity. Some jurisdictions require an overt act. An overact by anyone in the conspiracy is sufficient for us to meet our evidentiary burden of proving a conspiracy. Now, and often again, remember, because people don't ordinarily write contracts to enter conspiracies, you're going to infer that conspiratorial intent from the activities of the individuals. Now, how many parties for a conspiracy? Well, two or more entering into the agreement is a requirement. This is referred to as a plurality requirement. You can't conspire for yourself. A bilateral conception of conspiracy means the charge of conspiracy against one conspirator will fail in the event that the other party of the conspiracy lacked the required mens rea. A conspirator in a two-party conspiracy, for example, would be automatically acquitted in the event the other party was an undercover police officer or legally incompetent to enter into an agreement. Well, the bilateral approach is criticized for undermining the enforcement of conspiracy laws. You can't really use an undercover agent, for instance, because both parties must have the specific intent to engage in criminal activity and to agree to work together in pursuit of that criminal activity. The Model Penal Code adopts a unilateral approach. Only one person need have the intent to enter into conspiracy under this test. It's called the unilateral approach. The argument is that all you need is one person's criminal intent and an act in furtherance of that intent to enter into an agreement with another individual to achieve that goal for there to be a conspiracy. It really doesn't matter whether the other person enters into it. So you could have, for instance, an individual entering into a conspiratorial agreement with somebody who's legally incompetent to enter into that agreement. Under the bilateral approach, you would not have conspiracy liability. Only one party had entered into the agreement. Under the unilateral approach, that would be sufficient. So the commentary of the Model Penal Code notes that under the unilateral approach is immaterial to the guilt of a conspirator, the persons, or all of the persons with whom he conspired, have not been or cannot be convicted. So in other words, an interesting aspect of this is that under the unilateral approach, the fact that one party is an undercover police officer or lacks the capacity to enter into a conspiracy does not result in the acquittal of the other conspirator. Thus, is immaterial, the Model Penal Code notes, to the guilt of a conspirator that the person or all the persons with whom he conspired have not been or cannot be convicted. Now, the problem with the unilateral approach is obviously you've not really entered into an agreement if the other parties cannot or will not do that. And the fear is that allows the use of undercover agents to manufacture crime. The other side of that is, well, this just helps us protect society, and we're not, and otherwise we may be barred from using undercover agents or plants in various situations. Now, by far the most important aspect of conspiracy are chain and wheel conspiracies. The key is the defendant only may be found guilty of the conspiracy charged at trial, and they may offer the defense that that the evidence presented at trial did not fit the charge in the indictment. So, for instance, the charge may allege one large conspiracy. The defendant may say, no, there were two conspiracies, and therefore I cannot be convicted. So, a defendant may admit that he or she was involved in a conspiracy to kidnap and hold the corporate executive for ransom, but also argue that the other kidnappers entered into a separate conspiracy to kill the executive. Now, if there was a single conspiracy to kidnap, our defendant would be held liable for all acts in furtherance of that kidnapping, meaning the murder, or if there was a single conspiracy, the agreement may have been to kidnap and murder. If there were two conspiracies, our defendant could say, okay, I was involved in a conspiracy to kidnap, but there was a separate agreement between individuals they were going to kill this individual in the event the ransom wasn't paid, for instance. Now, a chain conspiracy is really typically arises in the distribution of narcotics and other contraband. In U.S. v. Bruno, 88 defendants were indicted for conspiracy to import, sell, and possess narcotics. This involves smugglers who once again, People versus Bruno involves 88 defendants indicted for a conspiracy to import, sell, and possess narcotics. Smugglers bought the narcotics into New York, sold them to middlemen who distributed the narcotics to retailers who in turn sold narcotics to operatives in Texas and Louisiana for distribution to addicts. The defendants appealed on the grounds that there were three conspiracies rather than one large conspiracy. Remember, some people brought them in and sold them to middlemen who distributed to narcotics retailers who in turn sold them to operatives for distribution to addicts. The court ruled that this was a single chain conspiracy in which smugglers knew that the middlemen must sell to retailers for distribution to addicts, and the retailers knew the middlemen must purchase drugs from smugglers. In the words of the court, the conspirators at one end of the chain knew that the unlawful business would not stop with their buyers, and those at the other end knew that it had not begun with their sellers. Each member of the conspiracy knew that the success of that part with which he was immediately concerned was dependent upon the success of the whole. Remember, this means that each and every member of the conspiracy was liable for every illegal transaction carried out by his co-conspirators in Texas and Louisiana, because everybody's part of this agreement. And all acts taken in furtherance of the conspiracy are charged against each individual. They're liable for all statements made by other individuals and acts carried out by other individuals, and we're inferring this chain conspiracy. A circle or wheel conspiracy involves a single person or group that serves as a hub or common core connecting various independent individuals or spokes. The spokes typically interact with the hub rather than with one another. In the event the spokes share a common purpose to succeed, there is a single conspiracy. On the other hand, in those instances that each spoke is unconcerned with the success of the other spokes, there are multiple conspiracies. The most frequently cited case in this area is Kadiakis v. U.S. Brown, the hub, assisted 31 independent individuals to obtain separate fraudulent loans from the government. Supreme Court held that although all the individuals were engaged in the same type of illegal activity, there was no common purpose. Everybody was only concerned about their loan, not everyone else's. Overall plan itself, separate from the others, although they were all alike in having a similar illegal object. Except for Brown, the common figure, no conspirator was interested in whether any loan except his own went through. As a result, the Supreme Court ruled that there were 32 separate conspiracies involving Brown rather than one common conspiracy. An example of a wheel conspiracy is State v. McLaughlin. Several gamblers independently agreed to subscribe to an illegal horse racing service that provided racing results and information. They all realized the success of their own financially expensive venture depended on the willingness of each of the other gamblers to support the service, and the defendants were held liable for one single common wheel conspiracy. Once again, all conspirators liable for all acts undertaken in furtherance of the conspiracy. Another aspect of conspiracy to just touch on here is the crime of conspiracy traditionally punished agreements to commit a broad range of objectives, many of which would not be criminal if committed by a single individual. Thinking was these same acts assume an added danger when engaged in by a group. Thus, in 1832, English jurist Lord Denham pronounced that a conspiracy indictment must charge a conspiracy either to do an unlawful act, murder, or a lawful act by quote-unquote unlawful means. English and American courts interpret unlawful to include acts that are not punishable under the criminal law. It's enough that they are corrupt, dishonest, fraudulent, immoral, or in that sense illegal. And it is in the combination to make use of such practices that the dangers of this offense consist. Don't want to get you too confused here, but example. In the early labor law of this country, the doctrine conspiracy was used against workers who went on strike to protest against a fellow employee who agreed to work below union wages. You're allowed to protest the employee working below union wages, but not through unlawful means, a strike. The English House of Lords, England, upheld a conviction of an individual for conspiracy to corrupt public morals, an unknown offense, who agreed to publish a directory of prostitutes. Well, modern statutes generally limit the criminal objectives of conspiracy to agreements to commit crimes, so you really don't have to worry about this, but here and there you're going to see examples of state statutes that punish lawful acts by unlawful means. So, a number of other doctrines we need to pay attention to. Remember the Pinkerton rule. You're liable for all acts in furtherance of conspiracy that are reasonably foreseeable as a natural, foreseeable as a necessary or natural consequence of the conspiracy. Wharton's doctrine. This provides that an agreement by two persons to commit a crime that requires a voluntary and cooperative effort of two persons cannot constitute a conspiracy. The classic example of consensual crimes that require the participation of two individuals and do not permit a charge of conspiracy under Wharton's rules are adultery, bigamy, the sale of contraband, bribery, and dueling. The offenses already punish a cooperative agreement between two individuals to commit a crime, and there's no reason to further punish individuals for entering into a conspiratorial agreement. The Gabbardi Rule, G-E-B-A-R-D-I, capital G, provides an individual who's in a class of persons that are excluded from criminal liability under a statute may not be charged with conspiracy to violate the same law. In Gabbardi v. United States, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed a conspiracy conviction of a man and woman for violation of the Mann Act, which prohibits and punishes the transportation of women from one state to another for immoral purposes. The court reasoned the statute was intended to protect women from sexual exploitation, punish individuals who transported women, and that she should not be held criminally liable under the Mann Act because the crime required the participation of two individuals, and you cannot enter into a criminal conspiracy. That would be Wharton's rule requiring two individuals. The Gabbardi rule says that she was in the class of persons who were excluded from criminal liability in that she was, the law protected her, and she couldn't be charged, therefore, with a conspiracy. Now, if our defendant had entered into an agreement with a third party to transport her across state lines, those two individuals could be held liable for a conspiracy. She, in no case, could be held liable for that participation in a conspiracy. So, think about it. Conspiracies are typically not based on explicit agreements. Intent is inferred. Defendants may be prosecuted for both conspiracy and commission of the crime, the object of conspiracy. Let me note a prosecution may be brought in any jurisdiction in which the defendants entered into a conspiratorial agreement or committed an overt act. So in a nationwide conspiracy, you're liable to be prosecuted anywhere. If you bring in a bunch of defendants to be prosecuted in a single trial, it's very easy for a minor conspirator to be kind of dragged in and prejudiced by the fact that they were involved with a conspiracy with these major figures that people have no sympathy for, and you have the problem of guilt by association. All conspirators are held responsible for criminal acts and statements of any co-conspirator in furtherance of the conspiracy. And let me just say this, that individuals may abandon a conspiracy and escape liability for future offenses only if this abandonment is communicated to the other conspirators. Some statutes require the individual to persuade the other conspirators to abandon the conspiracy. It's very hard to get out of it. And let me just mention the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, passed in 1970 by the United States Congress. And it provides another conspiracy-like statute for prosecutors. The RICO law essentially eliminates the need to prove individuals are part of a single conspiracy and instead holds individuals responsible for acts of racketeering undertaken as part of an enterprise. Racketeering includes a range of state and federal offenses typically committed by organized crime, including murder, kidnapping, gambling, arson, robbery, bribery, extortion, and dealing in narcotics and obscene material. So in other words, you don't have to prove individuals are part of a single conspiracy. You just have to know that they're part of this racketeering enterprise. And once part of the enterprise, you don't have to prove an agreement between the parties. You only have to prove knowingly being a member of this organization, and then you're held liable for all acts undertaken in furtherance of this organization's purpose. So, I may just be an accountant in an organized crime organization. I'm a member of this organization, and I'm basically aware of this organization's purpose. I don't have to be aware of each and every act. I'm going to be held liable for being a member of the organization and all acts undertaken in furtherance of the organization's purpose. The RICO laws. So you might want to look at some of the statutes on 212 in terms of conspiracy. So again, a conspiracy is an agreement or an agreement and overt act in furtherance of an agreement. Specific intent or purpose to commit a crime is required. Case on 213, very interesting. Illinois case. You have a number of individuals who are engaged in a series of conspiratorial agreements to burn down competing stores in this town. And you have, as you have in this case, are a series of arsons between Ham and Hanlon, retaining an individual named Rogers to carry these out. And at some point, also agreeing to hire Clapp and Bennett, who, although they ultimately don't engage in the arson, they carry out a insurance fraud scheme dealing with an automobile accident. At this point, they seem to engage in various acts of conspiracy as well. So you have Ham and Hanlon retaining Clapp, Rogers, and Bennett to engage in arson, and at some point they even attempt to steal a truck that has cigarettes, so they engage in some kind of black market sale of cigarettes. All these conspiracies really seem unrelated, but the court finds that a single conspiracy. It says an evidence shows a conspiracy designed to generate income to the individuals involved by means of arson and mail fraud, and that every single incident served to further the scheme, be it by generating money to the conspirators, wiping out the competition, or covering up the existence and or actions of the conspirators. And it says that it's clear the co-conspirators embraced the common goal of the conspiracy and continued towards the goal over a period of years. But note, every conspirator in this conspiracy, therefore, is liable for the acts of every other individual. And it also tried to bolster the ongoing evidence of the ongoing conspiracy by showing similarity in manner in which the crimes were carried out, and that this was a situation of long-term coordination between the individuals, with a division of labor between the parties. So, again, whether there's a single conspiracy or multiple conspiracies is very important in terms of the scope of liability of the participants. Look at the U Decide on 216 for an interesting problem in the law of conspiracy. The cases and comments also are really interesting examples. Our last inchoate crime, our solicitation, is commanding, hiring, or encouraging another person to commit a crime. So this is about the greedy spouse who approaches a contract killer to murder his or her partner in order to collect insurance. The act of proposing the killing of a spouse with the intent that the murder be carried out constitutes solicitation. Solicitation is a form of accomplice liability, and in the event the spouse is murdered, both the greedy spouse and the contract killer are guilty of homicide. In the event the assassination proves unsuccessful, both the greedy spouse and inaccurate assassin are guilty of attempted murder. An agreement between the two that leads to an overt act but which is not carried out results in liability for conspiracy. Well, again, commanding, hiring, or encouraging another to commit a crime. Solicitation remains a controversial crime that accounts for the fact that some states, this accounts for the fact that some states have not yet enacted solicitation statutes. The thinking is that there is no necessity for the crime of solicitation. Solicitation, is argued, is not a threat to society until some steps are taken to carry out the scheme. At this point, the agreement can be punished as a conspiracy. A solicitor depends on the efforts of others, and simply approaching another person to commit a crime does not present a social danger. There's also the risk that individuals be convicted based on false accusation or result of a casual remark. Lastly, punishing individuals for solicitation interferes with freedom of speech. So, On the other hand, there's good reasons to punish solicitation. Individuals typically encourage and support one another, which creates a strong likelihood the crime will be committed. An individual who is sufficiently motivated to enlist the efforts of a skilled professional criminal clearly poses a continuing danger. Thirdly, solicitation permits the police to intervene before a crime is fully implemented. The police should not be in a position of having to wait for the offense to occur before arresting individuals intent on committing a crime. States typically protect individuals against a wrongful prosecution and conviction by requiring cooperation or additional evidence to support a charge of solicitation. This may involve an email, voice recording, or witnesses who overhear the conversation. So, solicitation involves a written or spoken statement in which an individual intentionally advises, requests, counsels, commands, hires, encourages, or incites another person to commit a crime with the purpose the other individual commit the crime. You are not liable for a comment that is intended as a joke or uttered out of momentary frustration. 2. Mens rea of solicitation requires a specific intent or purpose that another individual commit a crime. You would not be held liable in the event you humorously advise a friend to blow up an expensive car of a neighbor who regularly parks in your friend's parking space. On the other hand, you might harbor a long-standing grudge against the neighbor and genuinely intend to persuade your friend to destroy the automobile. So the actus rea involves an effort to get another person to commit a crime. And a variety of terms are used: command, encourage, or request. 3 important points about solicitation. One, an individual is guilty of solicitation even in those instances in which the other person rejects the offer or accepts the offer and does not commit the crime. In other words, it is the offer itself. And in fact, the crime is complete the moment the statement requesting another to commit a crime is made. This is the case despite an additional step, such as a phone call, I'll call you to firm this up as to the date, or the payment of money is required to trigger the crime. Secondly, a statement justifying or hoping that the neighbor's automobile is damaged is not sufficient. There must be an effort to get another person to commit the crime. A solicitation may be direct or indirect. For instance, in cases involving the enticement of children and sexual activity, courts will consider defendants' use of suggestive and seductive remarks and materials. But again, it must be hoping that something occurs, or it would be nice if this happened isn't sufficient. You must try and persuade to command to direct. Thirdly, the Model Penal Code provides that an individual is guilty of solicitation even in those instances in which a letter asking others to commit a crime is intercepted by prison authorities and is never mailed and has not reached gang members outside of prison. And you can see a nice example of that in the cases and comments following the case on 219, Claxton. Well, Claxton is in the book to illustrate or raise the question whether our defendant here, Claxton, actually did solicit Tiny to commit murder. Did he really ask her to get rid of her boyfriend? Was her statement sufficiently direct, such that we can infer a criminal intent? Or was she just really engaging in a preliminary discussion or thinking out loud, or what really was her intent in this case? And how can we be confident under the circumstances exactly what she did say? So look at the facts here and decide, well, was there really solicitation for murder here? And why would she be so open about her intent? So view this problem and ask yourself whether there was solicitation.